long time ago on Veronica Mars.
Mysteries.
Plot holes.
Confusion.
Mars stuff. Just go with it, okay? Hoping it would be Leo at the door. I'm Jenny Owen Youngs.
Hoping it would be back up at the door. I'm Helen Zaltzman.
Hoping it would be not Duncan at the door. I'm special guest Duana Taha.
You're listening to Veronica Mars Investigations. Investigations!
Season 1. So, we are going to investigate some of the loose ends and open plot holes of Veronica Mars Season 1. And to aid us in our detective quest is special guest Duana Taha.
Hello.
Duana, you're a TV writer. You've worked in the televisions.
It's true. Making entertainment units one at a time.
Units. You measure it in units. Wow. Not in gills, not in acres.
That's the official measure, I believe.
And you're also a Veronica Mars enthusiast.
Yeah, I only realized how much when I started listening to this podcast.
Yes, and, hell yeah.
When I started cheering along in my car, I thought maybe my Veronica Mars enthusiasm is getting a little over the top.
Well, I feel like this qualifies you very well to tackle some of these queries that listeners have raised during the course of Season 1.
I am excited.
I'm excited. This is an interesting question from Vaughn, who asks, did Lynn Eccles know about Aaron Eccles and Lily? Before her death, Lynn tells Aaron that she always knew about his affairs in Neptune and only needed to have Aaron followed while he was on location. I have watched through the series at least 7 times.
Whoa.
And the thought of this only occurred to me recently. Could she have known about the affair and at minimum suspected Aaron's involvement with Lily's death? Duana,
ooh,
what do you reckon?
My gut is that as tolerant as Lynn was of whatever was not going on, I think this would have been a bridge too far. Her son's girlfriend, too much opportunity for crossover. I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I think she would have been too upset on Logan's behalf to do nothing. Because Lynn is like the only family member really that is even vaguely protective of Logan in any way.
At you know what? You're right. She would have known how hurt he would be. So yes, I agree. And certainly not about any implications for Aaron later.
Although she feared for her future if she and Aaron split up, with this she would have quite a lot of leverage compared to his other affairs because he would be involved with a minor. So she would have a lot more legal recourse and also tabloid recourse than with when he's just fucking some catering assistants.
Yeah, so if she had known their sort of fighting and conversation around the possibility of divorce probably would have been very different, like right after the stabbing, right?
I would have thought it would add something quite significant to that conversation.
Yeah.
You would speculate that, yes, if she was the kind of person who would reference the affairs, that she would also reference your tawdry and illegal situation with our son's girlfriend would kind of be the key bomb to throw there.
Yeah, yeah, especially because, you know, he's threatening, like, oh, if you divorce me, like, you're not going to get anything. You're going to be without money and without a home. She definitely would have had plenty of ammunition to toss back in that exchange.
I guess it also brings up the question of how long the Lily and Aaron affair was going on. Was it a few isolated, ill-advised incidents?
I think he and Lily would have been involved long enough for her to seem pretty comfortable when she's in the sex hut and is beckoning him forward, which suggests they've met several times. But it's still new enough that they're both excited about it in some way.
Also makes me wonder about the runtime of those tapes because,
yes,
you know, if it was many, many times, I assume there would be many tapes.
Maybe it wasn't always in the same location. Maybe it wasn't always in locations that were rigged with cameras.
Right.
Because also she was involved with Weevil at the time. So just how much time did she have for... It's like Laura Palmer. How did she have so much time for all of the multiple things she had going on?
Well, Veronica has many suitors.
This
and
is
she
true.
Makes it work. Also, I've recently been rewatching Xena Warrior Princess, and she seems to have had a romantic entanglement with every single strong, tall, broad-shouldered man that she encounters. Across Greece.
Huh.
Maybe the difference between people who get a show and people who don't are their ability to juggle infinite romantic affairs.
So they're just very productive.
Yeah.
In their sexual lives.
Can it be productive?
Well, you know how people are like productivity to like optimize your work time, but they're optimizing their sex time.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Also, we know that time doesn't operate the same way in Neptune, which is why you can get to other places so fast.
Certainly. Yes,
except for Barstow, which you have to fly to. This is a good query from Weevildoer.
Yeah, that's what somebody coined that term for allegiance with other people who were into Weevil.
How did Weevil find the secret message pen hidden in the air vent, but not the sex tapes of Erin and Lily, also hidden in the air vent?
Well, weren't there more than one air vent in Lily's room? Wasn't there one to the right of the door and one to the left of the door?
Whoa, Detective Youngs.
You've
been checking
sure.
the blueprints for the Kane house.
Yeah, you know. Also, if Weevil saw those tapes, would he take them?
Yeah.
Or would he just be like, here's the thing I've been looking for whatever reason, this whatever secret reason, we don't know exactly why.
Was the spy pen even in the air vent?
Or was
it just a pen that is a disguised pen? Why would you need to hide it? And also, is an air vent a good place to hide anything?
But especially because I think a lot of people knew that that's where Lily was hiding things. Didn't Duncan take us there at one point and say that she was hiding things? I may be misremembering, but it didn't seem like it was a terribly secret hiding place.
I feel like Duncan would know. Veronica knew.
Logan knows.
I would hide things probably in plain sight more than that.
Oh, maybe just put it in your pen holder, but with a little fedora and a trench coat and a magnifying
yeah,
glass
a fake
in
mustache.
The pocket. Uh-huh.
Very nice.
Yeah.
We should sell those in the merch. Pens in disguise.
I did kind of wonder if Spy Pen was just very clever rebranding of pen.
I also thought there is ample room in many pens' chambers for some notes.
It seems that way, yeah.
Mm. But yeah, I think Weevil would take them just in case it was
hot.
Useful. I don't know whether he would watch them, but I think he would appreciate an object of value that he could use if he was at disadvantage in an altercation with someone richer than him.
Having tapes is always better than not having tapes.
How many tapes have you got on people in your evidence?
Actually, I would suggest, based on what we've learned about the people in Neptune, probably it's better to not have tapes than to have the tapes that are available in Neptune, which largely seem to be homemade child porn.
Right. Okay. So
by legal standards.
Maybe Weevil didn't want to land on the sex offender register.
It's possible. He's the only one who's not on there at this point, I think. Someone called Bridget insists that we address, what did Weevil take out of the spy pen? I've watched Veronica Mars repeatedly, and I don't believe we ever get an answer. The people need to know.
I assumed it was a note that confirmed that he and Lily were involved, and thus would have cast suspicion on him as her murderer. But that feels like a boring suggestion now that you've set it up.
Well, a note that indicates they're involved, like, definitely seems like the vibe. But I think maybe even further, like, at this point, like, whenever she got this note, it was probably around the time that, like, she was becoming less interested in Weevil or maybe pushing Weevil away. So it might have been more frantic in nature or more like, are you seeing somebody else? If you are, I'll kill them. Or, you know, it could have been a little more aggressive. Or
also, remember that episode where he's in class reciting what appears to be an original poem, but is song lyrics.
You think he just put some Social D lyrics in that spy pen?
Or some O-Town.
But I love the idea of something that, yeah, could implicate him in the disappearance, whether it was vaguely threatening or just otherwise implicating him. The lyrics of Liquid Dreams, I assume, would fall under that umbrella.
It is a crime.
But yeah, I guess regardless, Weevil has more to lose. It doesn't seem like theirs would be a relationship that would be heavily text and word based.
I have a question. Why would Lily bother with a spy pen to pass notes to her lovers, but just keep a load of dick pics loose in the air vent?
Because she loves the drama. The drama of a spy pen, the drama of loose dick pics. I mean, it all adds up to a good time, I think.
Yeah. If it was too easy, then how would she fill her time? She'd have to pick up yet another lover to fill in those extra hours.
Do we all have to keep saying lover just because she did?
Lovers. Lovers is what she says. And I think she's doing it to wind you up, Jenny. That's her gift from beyond the grave.
Nice. Thanks, Lily.
But also, we find out quite early that Lily and Weevil were involved. Therefore, I forget that a lot of the characters do not know this, either for a long time or ever. Like, Logan knows and Felix knows, but Veronica doesn't really get it confirmed for a really long time. And maybe they're the only ones who know?
I don't know. If you go too far down the number of things Lily was keeping from Veronica, then the best friendship situation starts to get a little worrisome. I should probably end that thought, yeah. but that's where we are.
Well, I do feel like they, in a couple of years, wouldn't really be best friends anymore, like when Lily goes to college.
Oh, absolutely. And sort of would flee to their separate corners that got more and more different.
A sense of sad friend breakup in their future.
Yeah.
Which is why Veronica murdered her. The greatest twist. Victor wants to point out the inconsistency of Veronica understanding Weevil's uncle speaking Spanish in episode 5 when they go to the car yard that he works at to find out where Troy's dad's car is, and she understands when Weevil's talking to him in Spanish. And then Veronica doesn't understand the Spanish-speaking dog napper minions in episode 19. Has she forgotten Spanish in that period?
The only thing I could really get to with this is maybe because there were so many men all speaking Spanish at the same time.
And very indignantly.
Very indignantly. And they were also doing a lot of like rodeo pantomime. You know, that's very confusing.
Yes.
So maybe all of that added up to making it very difficult for Veronica to parse what everybody was saying.
I think that's fair. I think if you learned a language in class, then you're still not necessarily fluent at it to understand it in angry situations rather than single person talking quite slowly situations.
Right. The closer it sounds to the recorded voice on the tape, the more likely you're going to be able to pick out enough to understand via context.
I was quite impressed that she managed to understand enough of what they were talking about, which is a sexy silhouette of a girl on mudflaps in the dog napper scene. I just thought that was a decent level of Spanish comprehension to understand that much. Or mime comprehension.
Yeah, I feel like it was really about the... I'm doing something with my hands right now.
It looks like you're miming either enormous breasts or kind of a high Santa stomach.
Take your pick. I feel like that's what it looked like in the show, too.
Also clever of them, I guess, to try to express it to her via easily identifiable mud flaps that you can see without having to go anywhere, break into anything, you know.
Yeah, it's truly a miracle that those are the first, that's the first set of those mud flaps she bumps into after it's having this conversation.
Convenient.
They're very popular.
Oh, yeah. Crystal wants to know whether our opinions about the show have changed as we've done a deeper dive into season one. Do you expect analysis of subsequent seasons will shift your opinions about the show as a whole?
Good question.
Duana, how do you feel about it? As we've been analyzing it in your ears, have we ruined it for you?
No, it is one of those shows that I never get tired of watching, even as I discover some of the things that you illuminated that in retrospect are really not ideal.
It was funny to me how watching it before, just the only things that stuck were kind of the long arcs and the emotional relationships between like Veronica and Keith and Wallace and stuff. None of the mysteries of the week stuck. And I also didn't really notice some of the things where you're like, now that I'm watching it multiple times and taking copious notes on it for podcast.
I didn't watch it until right before we started making this podcast. I watched the whole series.
Not even suspecting what was about to crash into your life.
Having no idea what kind of havoc was about to be brought down upon me, Helen. I feel like I'm still developing my initial feelings about the show, you know?
Mm.
I definitely watched it so fast and so furiously that I don't think I really took in like a ton of the sort of like questionable things or the stuff that doesn't hold up as much. I more was just like, woo, wild ride. Wow, every boy is in love with Veronica. and the tiny jackets and Argyle, of course. Like those things really stuck. And this subsequent nearly immediate rewatch is definitely illuminating for me.
I do think that it's made me dislike certain things about this season more, because in my memory, this season was pretty impeccable. And obviously now I've made many hours of podcasts suggesting that it isn't. But I do wonder whether approaching it like I would have critiqued a book when I was studying English will make me enjoy some of the weaker spots more. Because I don't remember loving season three when I was just watching it for fun. But maybe I'll like it more next
That's
time.
Interesting. Yeah. I definitely think it's one of the shows that doesn't benefit from binge watching. The suspense of what are we going to find out back when it was airing week to week definitely was working, I think, in its favor. because I agree with you, I think the conventional wisdom is always that season one is pretty seamlessly plotted and paced. Looking back, you kind of go, well, was it? I do think it's addictive for sure, but maybe that we forget the sins that are committed in service of getting us to the end of the plot of the week, the mystery of the week, are a little bit lost in your memory or Weevil's eyes.
Yes. Also, every episode is so dense, like so densely packed with like things happening that like having a week to digest all of that would probably be very beneficial before starting a new episode. It's always just like 8,000 things are happening.
And they're all so stressful.
Yeah.
I also think at the risk of being inside baseball-y, that it's just amazing to look back now at the demands of a 22-episode season.
Woof.
Yeah, and Kristen Bell's in nearly every scene.
Every scene.
And so many night shoots as
and
well.
To have everything that she's doing in every episode keep up that pace and danger and drama when the Lily Kane mystery and the mystery of the party and her rape.
And finding her mom.
And finding her mom are really, the substance of those episodes alone really could be contained in, dare I say, 10, 12 maybe. That there are there's a lot of extraneousness that comes with what was a full season order circa 2003-04.
Yeah. Yeah, let's put the murder to the side for a little bit because there's a dog lost.
But then also there's a goat that's been stolen. But then also Parrots. Where'd that parrot go?
Now back to the serious crimes. I seem to remember reading interviews that suggested they had to adjust that a bit in season two so that she wasn't working all the time.
Yeah, I remember that being the case, that there were plot lines that were maybe less well received because they were conceived of maybe after the fact, I assume, maybe after contract negotiations, to make sure that she wasn't on a 22-hour-a-day kind of gig.
So I first watched this like 2008, 2009, when Lo, who provides our legal knowledge, lent me the DVD box set. And then I watched it in 2018 when I was in hospital for 3 weeks and I didn't really have internet, but what I did have was the first three seasons of Veronica Mars on my computer. So my husband would come by and visit every evening. We'd watch two episodes of Veronica Mars. So at the time, it was just escapist, which is weird because it's really not an escapist show in the main.
Why can't I escape to a reality where rape is almost almost present in every single day of life?
A lot of brutal violence.
Yeah.
Absolutely no indication that anything's going to be okay at all. Mm-hmm. It's, that'll send you right off to sleep.
But you, having written on Degrassi, a show set in high school and presumably employing a lot of teens or adults who look a bit like teens.
Yes.
Yeah, explain teens to us.
Yeah, what are teens?
What are they all about?
Oh, well, teens in the context of television are absolutely atrocious because if they're young enough to actually be authentic about what you're trying to portray, they're too embarrassed to actually do it. There's nothing like, you know, a scene with a 16-year-old having a first kiss who is anxious because the actor in question has not had the first kiss. So
that's pretty grim, I think. You hear about this with a lot of actors that their first kiss was on set. It seems a bit unfair.
Yeah, and they never want to say so. And there's a whole bunch of adults looking at them like, come on, get it right.
Our jobs depend on you, child.
I do think it's always better if it's a show where there are many, many young people so that the pressure isn't just on one of them. But yeah, the alternative is short or otherwise young-looking 24-year-olds playing 15 and suspension of disbelief.
How do you tackle this where you are older than the characters you're portraying, therefore you have different references to them that they probably wouldn't know about or use, like cultural references, but then if you did try and speak like a current teen, it would just be extremely hard cringe time.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of anxious Googling to see if you can find an authentic place for what are the kids saying without making your internet search history look too bad. It involves definitely watching those actors while they're reading it to go, if they wince or otherwise smirk, you're like, we'll just take this, take it to pink pages, take it to blue, see if we can young this up a bit.
Do you ever have like a, or does anyone ever have like a teen consultant?
Skins had a lot of teen writers.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least the British version did. I don't know about the American one.
Definitely on Degrassi, part of the read-through process was actors giving feedback on things that felt authentic or not. Or at my school, this happened and, you know, a bunch of writers furiously are writing and, you know, revising as they speak.
Oh, yeah. Do a lot of teens on Degrassi, like, reference like Brigadoon or like...
There's only so much suspension of disbelief and, you know, the fact that all these things happen at a school in Canada, of all places, is about as far as you can push the limits. Brigadoon would have been a bridge too far.
Oh my God! Was Drake on Degrassi when you were working on it?
I'm so sorry.
Everything just came crashing together in my mind at once.
It not only was he there, but I will tell you this because it's both delightful and embarrassing. On some level, I think that he and I share a songwriting credit.
Explain yourself immediately.
She wrote Hotline Bling.
No, there was a truly terrible situation that I still feel guilty about to this day, wherein the Jimmy character was going to rap on a song for his girlfriend. Tell me anything but the truth, cause I don't really know if I can take it now. Tell me anything but the truth, can't figure out how I'm supposed to make it now. So tell me lies, lies. And Aubrey, as he was then known, was like, guys, this is my thing. I don't really want to do this as Jimmy because I want to make a career out of this. And of course, everybody said, you're in a warehouse in North Toronto. Like, take it easy there. I don't think there was a huge amount of belief that that would happen. Long story short, we had to have some placeholder lyrics in the script, understanding that they would not be anywhere close to what the final product would be. And he very kindly incorporated them into what he wound up doing off the cuff, on the set, on the day, with absolutely no rehearsal, which, if you look on YouTube, is pretty spectacular and thematic, not just for the character, but for the time and the season. So Aubrey Drake Graham is fairly legit.
Helen in Sweden has pointed out that the sanitary product vending machine in the toilet office has no product information or prices. Maybe they're free. Or maybe it's just not kept up, so there's nothing in it.
I think it's not kept up. I think that's the Dropbox for if you're hiring Veronica for something. You have to slip a wad of cash into the out-of-order sanitary product vending machine.
I'm not sure how many I ever encountered in schools that were operational.
Yeah.
Most of them seemed like they were derelict and left over from an earlier time.
Yeah, I think ours were probably vandalized. I saw one in a hotel I was in St. Louis a few weeks ago, which not only had sanitary products, but also condoms and then also novelties. So in order to find out what novelties were, we bought one and it turned out to be a condom with Bin Laden on it.
Horrifying.
Not a prophylactically effective condom. It was really just for show.
Purely a comedic prophylactic.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like the kind of thing you shouldn't make a joke version of.
I agree.
It's interesting because the only vending machines in bathrooms that I've encountered that had like a novelty aspect were in the UK in like music clubs.
Yeah.
Where I have purchased a surprising little, like a miniature book that was just like slightly larger than a quarter that was kind of like a sex flip book. I don't know why that market exists.
Well, that's like, but we like to get off like the Victorians used to get off.
Also, just the idea that you need amusement in between, you know, the sink and the door.
Yes. Well, you know how a lot of people find humor attractive. Maybe you can buy it.
True.
To you impress your lovers.
Yes.
In episode 21, we open with this scene of Cuba, allegedly, and then Duncan reading the newspaper. And some listeners have been doing some great detective work about this. Bree on Twitter said that the place playing Cuba in that opening scene is El Prado, the main walkway in Balboa Park in San Diego. On the left, Casa del Balboa. Straight ahead, the California Tower at the Museum of Man. What's in the Museum of Man?
Like,
they mean man as in people or man as in specifically men.
Which maybe makes for a very specific museum.
I want you to know that I just zipped over to the San Diego Museum of Man website and the first exhibit that popped up is called Sea Cannibals, Myth and Reality. So cannibalism feels, you know, genderless to me, I guess is what I'm saying. So I think people, not just men.
In which case, maybe they're going to rebrand that museum title someday.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And then Duncan is reading a paper, which, according to Ashra, who is from Vancouver, is Canada's own Globe and Mail.
It is a very exciting moment in every rewatch of this episode because it's very exciting to go, look at us, we do exist.
Yeah. She thought maybe it's some insight into where the Cuba scene was shot, but as we know, it's in San Diego, which is some distance from Canada. So then Carl says, my theory as a Canadian and a former Globe and Mail feature editor,
whoa,
is that Canada didn't participate in the Cuban embargo, so the show probably figured that would be a foreign paper Duncan could get in Havana.
Carl!
Oh, wow, Carl.
Great detective work from all of these people. Very proud of you.
Definitely, Cuba was a vacation destination that was very common in long Canadian winters. Ooh. And it took a long time before we as Canadians understood why it was that everybody was from Britain or Hungary or anywhere else, but you never met anybody from the US. So I can see that being the case.
Well, I was curious as to how Duncan got in.
Maybe he has a fake Canadian passport along with the...
Oh, he did buy a fake...
Right, he
like,
bought an Argentinian passport from eBay.
And then the same episode, Kevin Seamus was wondering about the building where Logan takes Veronica for some smooching and then she leaves because it turns out to be rigged up with cameras. And he says, if that building is the pool house, what's the building Logan has in the poker game? I don't doubt the Eccles is having two standing bungalows on their property, but it did make me wonder.
I was thinking about this too. They definitely seem to be very different buildings.
They really did. A lot more windows. It was bigger. Didn't seem to have hidden cameras in it.
No face curtains.
And I would assume as well, because some people are like, is that Logan's room? I think you see Logan's room in that episode where it's his mum's funeral.
Yeah.
But also, different. Why would Logan have curtains with his parents' faces on in
terrifying.
His own bedroom? Or in his sex hut, though, to be fair. Like, I know teenage boys can sex it through most things, but still...
It's a very specific kink if that was what he was into. I've never had a pool, so I'm a little bit flying blind, but I assume a pool house is meant to be to change and refresh and so forth post-swim.
I've stayed in a friend's pool house in LA, and there was an office in it, a bed, a full like shower room, a drum kit. So I think a lot of people have them as guest houses.
I was going to ask, what distinguishes a pool house from a guest house?
The proximity of a pool.
So do we think the Eccles mansion could be the kind of place that would have both a pool house and a guest house?
Yeah. I wonder whether like one of them as well is like built to be servants' quarters or something. And then it just gets taken over by more Eccles shit.
Right.
In that same episode, Lawsy wonders, when Logan reminded Veronica about the air vent hiding place, why didn't Veronica go straight to Lily's? I guess because the Canes don't like her.
She's sort of persona non grata.
Right. Duncan has just made it very clear how not on board with Veronica is because he left Logan's party.
And then attacked that defenseless car.
So how would she get in, even though she does know probably all of the entrances to every building in Neptune? What about if she stashed herself in a plant pot and got Wallace to deliver it?
That is a great idea. It's worked once before on a smaller scale. Keith could show up in a little cap and coveralls and be like, gotta check your pipes.
Do love a Marvin costume.
And then just
costume.
Have her in a huge toolbox.
She could just go disguised as a window cleaner because their glass house must need a lot of maintenance.
Yeah, and they have no facial recognition for anyone who works for them.
No, exactly. Servants are invisible. They're just lumps.
It does seem like a real error in preparation on Veronica's part not to have some sort of outfit available for that kind of occasion. Uh-huh, she has something for every permutation of disguise.
She's got catering wear. She's got gamer girl anime outfits. She's got a wedding planning binder that's very thick.
She's got the pink outfit just to dupe men with.
Sure, sure.
Also, she doesn't know that she's looking for anything in the vent until the next episode when Logan tells her that he's written this exonerating letter. So at the end of episode 21, she isn't in search of something.
Right.
In episode 14, where you've got this horrible plot where Veronica is trying to defend Mr. Rooks against this accusation that he's been having an affair with a student.
We agreed we would never talk about this episode again, Helen.
At the end, the critical clue is just found by Veronica going to the phone book and being like, Susan Knight. Oh, there's only like one Knight in the phone book or whatever. And going to her house where she still lives, even though she says she's estranged from her parents. So to me, that felt like a real writing shortcut just to be like, fixed it with the phone book.
There's also the fact that subsequent viewings of this, young people will not know what a phone book is. Or why it would just be out there in the middle of the world.
Right. Why you wouldn't just DM Susan on Instagram.
Right. Or otherwise. This is one of the problems about Neptune, that if we sort of assume that not only is it relatively small, but all these people have known each other for a long time. So you'd think that at some point, Veronica would have dropped Susan Knight home from a 10-year-old birthday party or something.
Yeah, right.
Well, also, she's asked Wallace for enough favors. I'm sure she could have got the address just from Susan's file.
Ooh.
Also true.
Wait, so why did they do that then? I'm just thinking now, like, what was the point of an extraneous phone book scene?
It would have raised fewer questions for me if she just turned up at Susan's house and we hadn't known how she came to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But then I suppose it wasn't in the top five objectionable things about that episode. I also felt like the plot in episode 3, where she's trying to find Justin's missing parent, John Smith, by sending out all these letters to John Smith listed in the phone book and waiting for one to come back. That seemed like a very messy plot to me as well for trying to find this guy.
Yeah, I do remember reading once Rob Thomas saying if they were authentic about everything that Veronica could do just by sitting at her computer, that the whole show would be sitting at her computer.
Yes, that's right. True. And also Justin's parent, they transitioned like 10 years before, but they're still listed in the phone book under their dead name.
That seems very weird, but I wonder if like things were difficult enough and like still so analog that like maybe she was listed like under her dead name and also her current name.
Right.
You know, as like two
totally separate entities.
Exactly.
Yeah. I suppose. Yeah. This is a complicated sort of question from Amanda, who says, the mystery is why I, and many, many others, obviously, like Logan so much. I consider myself an evolved modern woman who would be appalled if my partner went around punching people in my defense or being overly protective. But why does my brain think it's romantic when Logan does it? And is also able to forgive and forget actual bad stuff he's done, like the bum fights. Is it the character balance opposite Veronica, or the inherent charm of how Jason Doering plays Logan, or ingrained misogynistic societal norms? Who knows?
Probably a little from column A, a little from column B, a little from column C. And we love a problematic fave,
I suppose,
don't we?
You don't have to commit to a problematic fave. It's something that burns hot and fast and then out.
Yeah, true. And I think, too, when we meet Logan and he's so heinous and so over the top, there's no indication that he's going to be able to bend at all. So the fact that he changes must be because of his growing heart and his growing love. So it endears us to him and helps us conveniently forget the many, many unsavory parts of him.
I think also something that comes up quite a lot is that anger is hot and passionate in men, but really that's just covering up the fact that they're not necessarily encouraged, or especially not around the time this series was made, to express their emotions in a healthy way or in a compassionate way.
Yeah, I heard recently what is probably a cliche, that where there's anger, there's always fear. And if you look at Logan, you can see that pretty obviously, that he's pretty scared, and which brings out everybody's protective instincts. But not allowed to show it. So anger shows up. But you see how well he responds when he's shown the least bit of affection, I think.
Yeah.
And it makes you want to give him that much more.
I also think there's something to like what it does for us as people to watch someone in a story grow and change and like maybe angle themselves towards redemption, because it probably, I'm guessing, maybe gives us a feeling that, you know, that's something attainable for us as individuals, and or depending on like what your life is like, maybe it gives you hope for somebody else. I don't know. I could see that sort of like transferring very easily onto this kind of situation.
At what point of the season as well do you think people start feeling hot for Logan? Because do you think they do that before episode 6, when you see him being subject to violence by his father? But before that, he's like bum fights, dating Paris Hilton, just really classist and racist and disgusting. So do you think it's when this element of vulnerability comes in, because you realize he's in this awful home situation, that people can start feeling hot for Logan?
I think like getting a window into his domestic situation is maybe a seed, or like the door cracking open. But I think that makes it possible for people to really get on board at the point where I think it really starts to take off, which is when they kiss and Jonathan Taylor Thomas is like, ow, my face. I feel like he doesn't really start to seem like a likable, viable option that we're interested in until, or maybe when Veronica starts investigating the death of his mom. Like maybe that is the vulnerability that really opens him up to us. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Maybe I'm a pushover. But obviously, the kiss is the moment of full launch. But we were so primed for it. I think I remember the flashbacks in the dancing and nude swimming episode when Lily and Veronica and Duncan go to not the prom.
Yeah.
I think
it's homecoming.
Just limo party.
Party.
Weird formal homecoming.
Yeah. That's the first time we see him being a human and interested in, you know, able to spend time with all those guys in a way that is not being an absolute dick. And
right.
I think those seeds start early. And I can't remember if right around then we also see him sort of thinking about the memorial and so forth. So
yeah,
that's the same episode.
Yeah, those flashbacks are like essentially the material
episode
that he cuts
4.
From.
So yeah, it does start happening early, the Logan redemption arc.
I think, yeah, they really plant the seeds of love him. He was nice once. You can turn him back into, there's Beauty and the Beast vibes, I guess.
Jenny, you have made your Weevil affiliations very clear. You're gay for Weevil, somewhat gay for Leo.
Very gay for Leo.
Never really heard you being gay for Logan.
I like Logan a lot. I think he's very charming and charismatic. And I definitely like Logan and Veronica together. There's like just boundless chemistry. He's just not... of all the men I'll never sleep with, he's definitely, you know, down the ladder a bit. He's just not my type.
I will confess that I feel a real kinship in this room, because Deputy Leo and Weevil often are duking it out in my private dreams.
I'm afraid you're going to have to come down to the station, Weevil. And then Weevil says something snarky back to him. And
oh,
then...
no, don't cuff me, please.
Imagine those two are accidentally locked in a cell together. Come on.
Yeah.
She has.
I also never thought that I would have affection for somebody who had no ability to articulate any vowels or consonants until Deputy Leo. But love works in mysterious ways.
It is amazing what he manages to do with just a kind of sleepy creak, isn't it? Just
Is he eating a sandwich right now? Does he have some food in his cheeks?
I think maybe he's just had dental anesthetic and it hasn't worn off yet.
It's true. We should be maybe sensitive to perhaps like a permanent TMJ situation. I don't know. But he does a lot with what he has, I think.
I have a question. Leo, the character, is also established as Leo, the astrological sign, which places his birthday late July, August?
Yeah.
Veronica's birthday is established to be, I think, around July. It was definitely a summer birthday.
That's just incorrect.
Leo says he's 29 months older than her, but her birthday is not canonically at the beginning of the year. It's in the middle of the year.
But she is so obviously a Capricorn. She is like the Capricorniest Capricorn of all time, which would put her exactly in a 29-month age gap with Leo. These are just facts, Helen.
So you're saying Rob Thomas got Veronica's star sign wrong, and that's the problem?
I'm saying whenever they retconned that Veronica's birthday is in the summer, like down the line, that was a mistake. That was a terrible error.
I have perhaps a contrary opinion.
Interesting.
As a Leo born in August, we really only know about ourselves. That's kind of a known trait. But is Leo the kind of person who would put on being a Leo because it's just goes that nicely with his name?
Oh, you know? So he's doing a joke, but actually he's like a Pisces or something?
I wonder. You know, and also because somebody who's Leo may also be covering up that they are Leonard or Leonardo, Lionel, maybe.
Leonard.
And I feel like saying I'm a Leo and also a Leo stops people from asking questions.
So you think he's just doing a joke about his star sign also being his name?
It could be. Mm. Also, as we've been talking, I Googled, according to a Veronica Mars wiki, apparently her birthday is August 22nd, which if
the first day of Virgo, isn't
this
it?
This is the thing. There's a bit of a cusp happening.
Okay, I could see her maybe being a Virgo with like maybe strong Capricorn placements up at the top of her chart. I would accept that. She doesn't make sense as a Leo to me.
I agree with you, although she is as confident in her own abilities to a fault as a Leo is.
Sure, but she's more like mission oriented and more like nothing will stop me from completing the task. You know what I mean? She's more
driven.
Yeah, and like in an earthy way, not in like a fiery Leo way.
Right.
You know?
There's also that real rigid black and white thinking, I guess, that can be attributed to Virgos. I do think there is maybe an academic paper to be written about elements that prove that Veronica could be a Leo or not.
Sure.
You could do that paper, Jenny.
I would like to verbally and directly address Natalie in Seattle and the other 8,000 people who let us know that Purdy and Pongo did not have a litter of 101 puppies.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yeah,
to me,
that's whew. Purdy is in much better shape than we initially thought.
Still, though, she had a litter of what, like
14 or 15?
That's
there
a
seems
lot of
to
puppies.
Be some disagreement.
That's still a lot of puppies. I mean, that's getting up towards the record-breaking number of puppies in one litter. People have mentioned that it was Cruella de Vil who had amalgamated 101 Dalmatian puppies.
Natalie also asks what feels to me like a very important question for our listeners. What does Helen Zaltzman look like? Ah. I've never seen a picture. What do you have Google? But when I try to picture a personage that is as physically impressive as her voice, only human that comes to mind is Idris Elba. Helen, are you Idris Elba?
Oh,
Helen,
sure.
Please respond to that, and then I'm going to, Duana and I are going to describe you so that everyone can know what you're
tall,
all about.
Very handsome black man.
That's right.
Well, Idris Elba and I don't believe have ever been seen in the same room.
Interesting.
Make of that what you will.
The plot thickens.
Or does it?
Listeners, I'm in a room with Helen right now.
Hi.
Have you ever seen a great tower of flame with a commanding voice, an English accent, spectacles, an impressive resume?
Well,
yes. The ability to play the glockenspiel.
Oh, I did not know that.
Not well.
Good descriptor.
And the euphonium? Baritone horn.
Only when I was like 14. It was a brief period of my life.
You were a shorter Tower of Flame at that time.
You know, it's very bad to play a metal instrument when you're made of flame. It just gets very hot.
Heats up and then maybe there's some melting.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, that's as much as you need to know, listeners, about Helen.
But it's a lovely compliment, Natalie, that I'm sure would have dissipated if you had just hit up Google Images.
I would only also add that I think probably you and Idris have similarly impeccable posture.
Really?
Really.
We have good posture, do we? Well, that's nice for someone who generally works sitting in bed, hunched over a laptop.
You would never know, and I say that as somebody who slouches professionally.
Yeah, you sound very upright in all of your work, Helen.
Is that because of the accent thing again?
Probably. Probably playing a part.
Well, I'm sure there's still a lot of loose ends from season one that we have not managed to tie up, and mysteries that we've not managed to solve, but such is life. It's not all neatly solved. But I will say that is season one of Veronica Mars Investigated.
Cases closed.
That was Veronica Mars Investigations, Season 1.
Watch Season 2, Episode 1, and join us in a month to investigate it.
Find the show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at VMIPod for some excellent social media fun times.
The website where the show lives and you can come visit anytime is VMIPod.com.
I'm Duana Taha. You can find me on Twitter at Duana Elise, or on the podcast Show Your Work, available where you find fine podcasts.
I'm Jenny Owen Youngs, and you can hear more of my speaking voice on my other podcast, Buffering the Vampire Slayer. You could also alternatively hear my singing voice by going to JennyOwenYoungs.com and checking out all of the hot jams I have accumulated over the years.
Strongly recommend. I'm Helen Saltzman, and in the time before there is more VMI, why don't you listen to my other podcasts? Answer Me This at answermethispodcast.com and The Illusionist at theillusionist.org for factual entertainment.
This episode was edited and mixed by America's borrowed sweetheart, Helen Saltzman.
The music is by Martin Austwick and Jenny Owen Youngs.
How dare you? The sheriff of this town is Hrishikesh Hirway.
The show is distributed by PRX.
Until next time, who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
If we keep asking the question, we'll never have to answer it.